Good morning. Oh, would someone mind putting the water up there so I can... Thank you. I don't need that. This is fine. So this morning I'm going to talk about the Eightfold Path. And it's been about... I saw in my notes it's been more than 3 years since I've talked about it. And the reason I decided to talk about it is on Tuesday nights, people are giving talks on each of the eight components, 8 weeks in a row. And last week I heard Deb speak about the second, right intention. I don't know who's doing the third, but I know Wayne's doing the fourth, and I think Ann did the first. So I'm going to kind of contextualize this by talking about the whole path. But if you want to get the deep truth, come on Tuesday night. Okay. So supposedly in Buddha's first sermon, he talked about suffering. And he said there's an end to suffering, and the end to suffering comes by traveling on the path. And he said in another of his sermons that the type of suffering he's talking about was not the pain of pain. He was talking about the suffering from getting what we don't want and not getting what we want. But as for the pain of pain, there wasn't anything he could do about that. Tough. It just happens. But the suffering about our pain and the suffering about our pain was what the path is designed to help. So in your programs, you'll see that... I outlined the three main components of the Eightfold Path, which are the first two, understanding or view, but I prefer understanding, and intention or aspiration. That's the first one. That's considered the body of faith or the body of trust. So we have some trust, some faith that by traveling on this path, we're going to go through some kind of inner transformation. That's what we have some trust in that. And Buddha says it's like the trusting the interconnectedness, the way a bird trusts the tree it builds its nest in. So we hear about interconnectedness, and we hear about the deep calmness that comes when we feel interconnected, and then we embody on the path. And then the second component of the path is ethical behavior. So here we have, when you go through an initiation ceremony here, you're given the precepts, norms for ethical behavior. And then when you go through an ordination ceremony, become a priest here, maybe a few years later if you happen to go down that, you're again given the precepts about ethical behavior. Then finally, when you graduate after I don't know how many years, 6 or 12 or 20 years, what does the teacher do? Gives you the precepts of ethical behavior. So really built in. That's considered the first leg of the path, of transforming the faith component of the path, understanding and intention, into the wisdom component. So faith, it gets transformed into wisdom through the first leg, which is ethical behavior, and the second, which is meditations. So 6, 7, and 8 on the path are meditation. 4, 5, and 6 are ethical behavior. Pretty simple, huh? Pretty simple. So now I'm going to go through the path 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 in linear fashion, spending about 3 minutes on each. So understanding or view, right understanding, right view. Well, we came here the first time. You guys came here the first time because you had read something or you'd heard something that about some deep interconnectedness and about a calmness that could come from realizing that deep interconnectedness and not being caught by the narrative self, which owes its life to internal dialogue and which needs a life. It needs a life. But it's only a fiction, a necessary fiction, since all life is one interconnected, changing whole. So you get that some understanding and you come. And you come. How many of you remember the first book you read or the first thing you heard that brought you to a place like this? Raise your hands. Some of you don't remember. Huh. I remember so vividly, and it only happened about 53 years ago or something like that. I lose track of the time. The first book I read, I really remember it. And the second book and how I kept coming back to those books. So that's why it's the first component, because without that understanding, we won't practice. We won't practice. And then on the heels of that, or the second one, our commitment based on our aspiration, our intention. So right intention is the second one. Oh, we heard that. We heard that teaching. We read it. And now we have an intention, an aspiration to actualize that. We want to do that. We want to do that because... I remember just being blown away by the teaching when I first read about it. And so the components of intention or aspiration are imagination. You have to imagine yourself calmer, more connected, not caught by this little wheel in here. You have to imagine yourself that way. With that imagination, then you practice. You have the aspiration. And it takes courage when that wheel never seems to slow down and you've been sitting for 2 years. It never slows down. It takes courage to keep coming back, to keep coming back, to showing that determination. So when I was a young man, I went every Sunday to hear Suzuki talk in San Francisco. I did that to keep my aspiration alive, to keep my intention alive. And it was important to me, but you guys may have a different ways of keeping your aspiration alive. We all have different ways. And then part of aspiration also is vow, the vow that we chant here at the end today. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Dharma gates are innumerable. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is inexhaustible. I vow to become it. Well, that takes imagination, doesn't it? You're going to become Buddha's way? Well, that's your vow. That's your imagination. And you're going to become what you are, so it's not as hard as you think. It's what you are already. It's what you're going to become. You're just going to let go of not being caught continually by not getting what you want and getting what you don't want. That's all. That's all. So those are the faith steps or the trust steps, understanding and aspiration. And then we exercise the legs, the first leg being ethical behavior. You've got to have two legs. A one-legged person cannot walk, so there has to be ethical behavior and meditation. Right speech, as much as possible, honest speech, speech that doesn't hide, that isn't about subterfuge, that isn't about making a good impression, although of course we all want to make a good impression, but it isn't primarily about that. It's honest, it's straightforward, as much as possible. So my daughter is writing a book about Netflix culture, and one of the key, I think, 8 components of Netflix culture is direct feedback. That everybody is expected to give everyone else direct feedback. That means the janitor is expected to give the CEO direct feedback if the CEO hadn't cleaned his desk. It's true. And that's the core principle. She's got a whole chapter in her book on that core principle at Netflix. Direct feedback. Honest, open feedback. But of course, Netflix is not necessarily Buddhist, I don't think. So we complement that by compassionate communication. Direct communication is important, but also it needs to be compassionate. It needs to be embedded in a feeling about communication that will not be hurtful. Communication that someone will listen to. I want to give you direct communication, but I have to think about how I can give it to you in a way that you will accept it and it will be helpful to you rather than hurtful. So years ago, when I was with my teacher in San Francisco, in a car in the mid to late 60s, we got in this car. And the car was coming over to our Zen Center from the Haight-Ashbury, and we got in the car, and the car reeked of marijuana. It just reeked of marijuana. You know, it was an experience where all you had to do was breathe the air in the car, and you got high. I don't know if any of you guys ever remember this kind of thing, but if something reeks of marijuana, all you have to do is breathe the air. So we got in the car, and I kind of liked it, actually. That's another story. We got in the car, my teacher got in the car, we both breathed, because you have to breathe, you know. And my teacher knew exactly what was going on. The guy had just stubbed out a reefer in the next to him, you know, in the ashtray next to him. And my teacher turned to the guy and he said, "I'm not for or against marijuana." Compassionate. "I'm not for or against marijuana. I'm just trying to show people our way." So direct communication, our way. But compassionate, compassionate. Speech, action. Speech is good, but action is even better, even more important, right? Even more important. Action that is in sync with other people and still authentic to our own way of being. It is in sync with other people. Because if we're all interdependent, let's do action that's in sync with others. So, how many of you know the Myers-Briggs? Raise your hand. Almost everybody in this room knows the Myers-Briggs. Well, you may not remember the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension is the PJ dimension. And people who are high P are people who like spontaneity, who change their minds all the time. And people who are high J like to have their ducks in a row 3 months ahead of time, and nobody messes with those ducks. I got those ducks in a row, and I don't want any high P people in the room coming to mess with my ducks. Well, historically, I'm a very high P, very, very high. And my wife is a very high J, very, very high. And we have stayed together all these years. Wow, that's interesting, isn't it? I wonder how much therapy we had to do. I won't tell. So, let's see. What was I talking about? Oh, P&J. So my wife, so once we were getting ready to go somewhere, I don't know, and we're getting ready to go on 94, and she said, "Well, which way should we go?" And I said, "I don't know, let's just see what happens." And my wife has been reminding me of that for the last 25 years. As my P is just off the charts. I'm barely possible to live with me. But when I became an executive and then head of the Zen Center, I really had to pay attention, because if the leader is going like this and this and this from day to day, everybody else is going, "Ha, help! What's our direction?" So I've been working for all these years on tempering it. I don't know. Ted's not here right now. He was here the first one. We can see how well I've done at tempering it. I don't know. But I try. It's my effort to do right action. And right action also is action that's engaged. Not just engage Buddhism in a political sense, which is really important, but engage Buddhism in an interpersonal sense. in an interpersonal sense. That's what intimacy is about, engagement. Engagement. If we get codependent or we get enmeshed, we're not engaged anymore. We've just given up and we're just going with other people's ideas, and we don't have a self even. We're just totally preyed upon by them. Not that they're intentionally preying upon us. Maybe we come from an enmeshed system. That's not engaged. That's entangled and meshed. And then we hate that, and we run to the other extreme of disengagement, of hiding out, either hiding out mentally or hiding out literally, or running away. Not bad, but one is the mirror image of the other, and engagement is the Buddhist way, even though we don't know. It's not as solid and as stable as those other two, because we don't know, but we just do our best. If we know that we're feeling like running, usually it means because we're getting entangled. And then how can we correct the course? Maybe we do have to run for a while. Maybe we do have to hide out a little bit emotionally or literally before we come back to center to engage. To engage. That's what intimacy is about. Individuals and undivided. But undivided without individuals, that's just enmeshment. That's phony religion. Phony. It's not that we are phony, it's just that we're caught. We get caught. Speech, action, and livelihood. Livelihood. Right? Livelihood. Well, we're all right. Livelihood is the mission and core values of the place we work for, or the, do they accord with ours? Do they accord with what we consider Buddhist core values? Sense of interdependence, sense of connectedness, appreciation of tranquility. And we have to have enough of that in our place of livelihood, or we should change our place of livelihood. We should change our livelihood. But hopefully we can find it. People say, oh, I can find it more in the not-for-profit sector. Well, I was in the not-for-profit sector my whole life, and I don't think so. I don't think so. You can find it sometimes in the not-for-profit sector, sometimes in the for-profit sector. Sometimes not, though. And life is short, so livelihood's important. 40 hours a week for 30 years doing something, it has to accord with your inmost feeling, your inmost values. Important. So that's the first leg, the ethical leg. And the second leg, the meditative leg. Effort is the first one. Effort. Right? Effort. Well, the Soto Zen school is nothing if it's not about effort. Wholehearted effort in each activity. We just give ourselves to the activity. Whether it's washing the dishes or walking to the car, enjoying nature as we're walking to the car, we give ourselves to the activity. We make wholehearted effort. So it's not intense effort, it's just wholehearted. So it's not intense, it's just open. Open to the sky, open to the trees as we're walking to the car. Wow, wonderful effort. Wonderful effort. Beyond the measuring mind. So here's a story that I have not told in 3 or 4 years, I don't think. I'm not sure. But the story is about a Russian pilgrim. And the Russian pilgrim is going on a spiritual quest, on a meditative quest, to discover the peace that passes understanding. Jesus' expression, the peace that passes understanding, to discover it and within himself. And he has a chance to go see the bishop, the high up bishop who lives high on the mountain overlooking the lake. And the bishop, he goes up and he gets an audience with the bishop, and he tells the bishop about his pilgrimage and gets advice on how he should do his meditation, his meditative prayer. And the bishop gives him something to repeat. So he goes off and practices for a year. And then a year later, the bishop is looking out his window at the lake, and he sees the pilgrim. And the pilgrim is walking across the lake. And the bishop thinks, no, that can't be. He looks again, and yes, the pilgrim is walking across the lake. The pilgrim gets to the other side. He climbs up the hill, and he asks for an audience with the bishop, and the bishop said, oh, yes, to his attendant, yes, I want to see him. Pilgrim comes in, and he says to the bishop, Now, Father, I've been practicing what you told me for the whole year, and it's been wonderful, but I want to make sure that I'm saying it right. And the bishop said, oh, and the bishop is still just sort of transfixed by this guy's presence, and having seen him first walk across the lake. And he says, yes, my child, tell me, what have you been saying? And he says, well, I've been saying, may dog have mercy on my soul. And of course, the pilgrim didn't get Russian that well. He got low Russian, not high Russian. And so he said to the bishop, is that right? And the bishop said, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to follow you. And the bishop took off all his accoutrements and followed the pilgrim off into the wilderness. That's the story. That's about right effort, isn't it? That's about right effort. You don't need to measure. You get involved all in measuring. You just do it. What if you're saying dog rather than God? Who cares? Does dog care? Speech, action, and livelihood. And that effort, the first meditative component. The second and third meditative components are mindfulness, sati, and concentration, samadhi. Mindfulness and concentration. Now, I prefer, translation's not quite as literal, I prefer bare awareness and focus. And the reason I prefer bare awareness is mindfulness has become such a cliche. Nobody knows what it means anymore. Oh, I don't ever knew what it meant in the first place, actually. So bare awareness is a little more descriptive. And the other, concentration is good, but this is about focusing, not just concentrating. It's about focusing. So that is, in our tradition, in the Buddhist tradition, that's the mindfulness is quite analogous to what we call vipassana. Quite analysis. Vipassana, not as you may know it if you've been to Vipassana retreats, but historically Vipassana means insight. It means seeing into. So we sit on our cushion and we just watch our thinking. We just watch it. So my daughter just got back recently from Las Vegas to Paris, where she was. She lives in Paris, and she was in Las Vegas doing a presentation there. And she called me and she said, Dad, I said, how was Las Vegas, Aaron? She said, well, it wasn't that bad. And I said, really? She said, no. She said, I could see mountains outside my window. And she said, and there was a casino in the building in my hotel. And I said, yeah, but you don't gamble. She said, no, but Dad, when I went down there, do you know what it said on the inside? I said, no. And she said, well, Dad, it said, you must be present to win. She said, you'll have to come. So that's vipassana. That's vipassana. That's shikantaza. There's no technique. We're just here. We're just here. And we win. We're always winning. We're just winning by being here. We can't help it. The riches are just coming through. They're just coming through. So that's the Zen school is a shikantaza. In Zen, we focus on shikantaza, just to sit, not technique, just to be here, to be present to win. And this comes from, I think, Hui Neng in the first place, but then the second place from Dogen and Fukanza Zengi. In Fukanza Zengi, Dogen's instructions for meditation. Everybody, some people recite it. We used to recite Fukanza Zengi here during retreats at the end of the day. Dogen gives his instructions for meditation. And what does he say? He says, cease all movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts and views. And then he tells you what to do with your posture. He says, sit straight and try to sit in half lotus or full lotus and put your tongue on the roof of your mouth and make sure that your eyes are parallel to your shoulders. All these instructions, right? But you're still waiting for the meditation instructions, for the technique. What's the technique? And there's, and he says, once you've adjusted your posture, I think, oh, once I've adjusted my posture, then he says, here's the technique. He doesn't say, here's the technique. He says, think non-thinking. Once you have adjusted your posture, think non-thinking. And then he says, how do you think non-thinking? Oh, now we're going to get the technique. How do we think non-thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. The Zazen I speak of is not learning meditation. Right? Very interesting. Very interesting. And on the other hand, in Buddhism, we do have this rich shamatha tradition. This rich tradition of lots of calming techniques. Lots of calming things you can say to yourself, mantras, to help yourself. Being an eclectic person myself, I've always emphasized the shamatha as much as the vipassana, and I still do in my own practice. So when I was with my first teacher, the first year or so I was with him, he would just say, sit. You know, we'd ask for technique, and he said, oh, well, why are you trying to get something? Just sit. You're trying to get something. I have nothing to give you. Just sit. Like Wayne was saying about shahaku. What did shahaku used to say, Wayne?
This is good for nothing.
Good for nothing.
Zazen is good for nothing.
Zazen is good for nothing. So that's so typical. And it's wonderful. It's true. But it's complemented by the fact that sometimes we need help. We need help. Even after sitting for all these years, often when I sit down first, I need to do some shamatha stuff. And that's just as good, just as important. So with my teacher, first he taught us just to sit with no technique. And when I asked about technique, he'd say, well, is your tongue on the roof of your mouth? And I thought, what does that have to do with it? You know, are you sitting in half lotus? How can you get in half lotus? Well, what does that have to do with it? Here I can't even do half lotus anymore. I'm lucky that I can sit on a cushion at all. Right? But no, that's what he did. But after a year or so, I don't know, a year, year and a half, he noticed that people started dropping away. I mean, this is my theory. He never said this. And certainly my friends dropped away. And so then he started teaching, oh, follow your breathing, he said. Oh, so then he's, oh, here he's bringing some shamatha in, following your breathing. Very simple shamatha. Then after a while, people are still asking more. Then he's saying, oh, maybe you can count your breathing. So then he's teaching, by the third year I'm there, he's teaching people to count their breathing because they need something. They need something. Not everybody, but many people do. Then at the end of 3 years, he gives me a mantra, which is totally shamatha. It's not Zen. He says, Tim, you're having a hard time. You should repeat this mantra. And I think, is this the same guy that told me just to sit facing the wall and put my tongue on the roof of my mouth when I asked him for technique? But he was able to adapt skillful means for us Americans. For us Americans. So we're lucky we have this wonderful rich tradition of shamatha and vipassana, seventh and eighth steps of the path. Wonderful. Wonderful. So I just did a retreat here. In which it was supposed to be a contemporary retreat. Luckily, I didn't violate too many norms. It was supposed to be a contemporary retreat, but I did guided meditation after guided meditation after guided meditation. 2 days, every meditation I guided. That's shamatha, and people seemed to really appreciate it, really helped them. Someone during the last coffee hour was wearing a Buddhist rosary. And Buddhist rosary, that's shamatha practice. The what's it called? Mala. The mala. The mala. That's shamatha practice. You count each bead and you repeat something to yourself with each bead. I was with a really old Tibetan master once, and he was giving a talk. Before he started his talk, he counted each bead. That's what he did. He just did a shamatha practice quietly to himself. So anyway, by exercising these two legs, and we need the two legs, we transform the body of faith, the Buddha body, into the body of wisdom. We just realize that we're Buddha already, just as we are. just as we are. So then, our what's called Shraddha, faith in Sanskrit, turns into Prajna, wisdom. The Buddha body, our little frail, mixed up body, we realize it's the Buddha body, just as it is. And we have some wisdom, but that's not the wisdom what we first had when we just read that book. That's the wisdom that comes out of here. That's why it's called Prajna. It's jna means knowledge in Sanskrit. This is before knowledge, deeper than knowledge, is our wisdom. And we've settled into that by exercising these legs. And of course, often we get stuck in our practice. One of the legs is not doing too good, our sitting's not doing too good, or we get discouraged in our sitting, or we're making ethical compromises at work or at home or something. And why are we doing that? Why are we not exercising those legs anymore? Well, because we've lost our inspiration. We've lost our intention. And so then we need to go back again to that first step, to our understanding. You need to come hear another Dharma talk or hang out with a teacher or get on your app if you have an app. My daughter and wife will have nothing to do with Zen Center, but they're religious about their apps, their meditative apps. They just go turn their apps on when they lose their their meditation. There's one guy they think is the creme de la creme and kind of meditative app people. I've never done this. How many of you have done meditative apps? Raise your hands. Oh, do you have one guy? No? Anyway. What? No. Okay. So, we need that. So we come back. And so for me, I used to go on Sundays all the time in San Francisso. But then when I would get dry and I want, God, I just, my sittings would start being just putting in time and I felt like I could never do anything. Then I started coming on Wednesday nights, Wednesday and Sunday. So that was my inspiration. But that was my inspiration. Not everybody felt that way about Suzuki. Lots of people didn't feel that way about him. You have to find out what inspires you. What gets you back on the path when you get kind of dried up? Maybe it's that first book. Maybe you still have that first book, that first Alan Watts book. What did he write there? Read about it. Say it out loud. Listen to him online if Alan Watts is your guy. So many people, Alan Watts were their guy. You know, Alan Watts was one of my guys, too. Interesting. He was one of my guys in 1964. Some of you people, he was your guy in, you know, 30 years later. So my friend Sheridan, whom I go to visit when I go to California, who practiced with me in San Francisco many years ago, she stopped practicing Zen and went to start practicing another discipline. So when I visited with her 10 or 15 years ago, I said, Sheridan, you left Zen Center. Like I was a little hurt, even though I left Zen Center too, I was still hurt, you know. And she said, yes, well, you know, Suzuki, I kind of... You know, he really always confused me. I never admitted it, but he just confused me. He never expressed himself very clearly. He always said, just look at the wall. And plus, there was all this paradoxical stuff. She said, so I found a teacher who does a lot more shamatha practice. And I've been doing that ever since. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. That's great. That's great for you, Sheridan. That's great for you. Each of us has to find our own way of being on the path, our own way. And then my friend Randy that I used to meditate with when I lived in northern Minnesota, we just meditated together. But after I left, he gave up. And he said to me when he came down here to the cities, he said to me he thought he just wasn't cut out to do this. But we've been meditating for 2 years, so he wasn't cut out. But he never worked with a teacher. He never had a group. He never even, other than me, he never had a sangha. And I was gone, so he had no sangha. He had no teacher, so he thought, I'm not cut out for this. It takes a lot of discipline, but it shouldn't be dry discipline. Discipline from your heart. Go back to the teachings that inspire you over and over again. Find them. Maybe they're just little poems. Maybe they're just little poems. So yesterday I was up in Duluth visiting my cousin Mary. My cousin Mary just had an awful accident. She was hit and pinned down by a bus in Duluth. She almost didn't live, and she had one of her legs amputated above the knee. So I went up to see her in the hospital. So talking about the two legs, I'd already prepared this talk, and then I went up and she had a leg and a half. She just had a stump, and although she had it discreetly covered. But what about Mary? Wow. She said to me, these doctors have been so wonderful, so helpful to me. And they think that I can maybe walk again. And she said, I'm going to get a prosthetic leg. I can't get it for a few months. I have to heal better. And a prosthetic knee and a prosthetic leg. And I want to hike to the top of Wolf Rock, which is where we used to hang out near Two Harbors, where she had land. And she said, I can see myself doing that. And I thought, wow, what imagination. I was inspired. I thought, she should be giving the Dharma talk rather than me. She said, yeah, I can do that. And I said to Linda, look at Mary's commitment to her joy of living right there with her stump. And look at her courage, and look at her determination. And yet it was just coming out. The doctors had been helpful. She had the imagination. The doctors were continuing to be helpful, and she can see herself at the top of Wolf Rock. And I said to Linda, well, I doubt if she's going to be there in a year. Linda said, no, but maybe in 2 or 3 years. She's 72 with a prosthetic leg. Wolf Rock ain't easy to get to. It's not, there's not a trail, you guys. It's not that high, though. Around Two Harbors, the hills are not that high. But there you go. There you go. So I thought, well, if Mary can do it, us guys can do it. We can exercise those legs. We can open up to this deep, calm spaciousness that's always here, regardless of what's going on. Right in the middle of great pain, great suffering. We can do it. So that's what I want to say today. And I'll take questions or comments, if anybody has anything. Benton.
I like Brad Warner's instructions for Zazen. It's very simple. Sit down and shut up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he's in the Soto tradition.
Right.
He would, Shohaku would like him. They'd do well together, although I don't think they'd do well that well. He's so unkempt, and Shohaku is so, have everything so tidy and so neat. Other people, yeah.
I just want to say I really liked your story about your cousin Mary.
Pardon?
I really liked your story about your cousin Mary.
About my cousin, uh-huh. Yeah, well, thank you. And now, you know, I can't wait to go up and see her again. I have to say that I was kind of dreading going up there. And I got my wife to go with me because I just felt, ugh. But then, after being there, I want to go up there again next week because she inspired me so much. So inspired by her. So I said to Linda last night, I said, let's take the grandsons up there as soon as they get here. And she said, are you kidding? I said, no, I'm not kidding. And she said, well, what are they going to do? Well, she sits there. And I said, oh, they can run around. So, yeah, that's my next, one of my next activities. As soon as those boys come, I said, get them to go up there. They can see her and be inspired by her. I know they won't sit with her because they don't sit, those boys. They don't know how to sit. Not part of their... But they know how to move. other people. Yeah, Roger.
You mentioned your first book. And you didn't tell
Pardon?
You mentioned that a book you read.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first book I read was The Teachings of the Mystics by W.T. Stace, which is probably out of print. But I think the second book I read was a book by Alan Watts. And, of course, lots of times now people say their first book was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I'm touched by that because I heard my teacher give those talks in California, and they were barely decipherable. He had a great editor. You think my books are good, but you don't know Wanda. My editor. That was my first book. And The Teachings of the Mystics is still in my... It's fallen apart. I have it taped together. And I have it in a drawer because it can't fit on the bookshelf because it's all deteriorated. I think it's out of print. But that was a book for me because... It didn't just dip into the Buddhist tradition. It talked about the Christian tradition, the Muslim tradition, and this deep peace and quiet and interconnectedness. And I thought, wow, that's good. Other people. Yeah. Jim.
Thank you for making the connection between aspiration and imagination. It really helps me to have that that encouragement to imagine.
Good. Yes.
Being, you know, I want to do something. It's, you know, hold it in mind. And
yes. Yes.
And it reminds me of something I heard recently, which is that someone said worrying or worry is a waste of imagination.
Ah, pretty good. Did you guys hear that? Worry or worry is a waste of imagination. I like that. I like that. Anything else? Yeah, Carrie.
I appreciate what you said about, you know, finding a connection, right? I mean, for meditation practice and something that, like, ignites it again. And like you said, you went to another sitting when you found it dry. Appreciate that you gave a different kind of contemporary treat, although I wasn't able to attend. It feels very open and accepting of how, you know, how in practicing our zazen there is that opening.
Well, good.
Because I know that for me, I had practiced other forms of meditation before I came here, and for me, so it wasn't more a book; it was a person. It was Ben. Ben was my director. And that for me continues to be the teachers here. Continue to be people that I feel very connected to.
Thank you.